guys, welcome to another episode of the Meaning of Podcast. I am Ace, this is RB3, and this is a podcast where we get into the deeper meanings of your favorite film directors working in Hollywood today. And today, we are talking about MCU movies, which is all the rage right now because there's Thor Ragnarok and Justice League coming out in the same month, and it's becoming very competitive. It's becoming kind of aggressively handled as far as how people talk about MCU and DC
versus Marvel, you know,
it's so dumb. It's so dumb, guys. But anyway, as I'm wearing my DC shirt, there you go. But yeah, guys, we're going to be talking about MCU movies, what works, what doesn't work, what is their theme, why it makes so much money, all that kind of stuff. We're going to be talking about some of our favorites as well as taking your questions. But before we do that, last week we had our Halloween episode where we talked about Halloween movies, horror movies, and the themes and tropes that keep coming up in all these movies. So we want to take a look at your questions. Please always send us your questions, your comments, guys, because we will be reading them. So if you want to have your comment read, just comment on the YouTube channel or comment on our Schmoville post, because we post this video on Schmoville as well. So yeah, make sure you guys leave comments because we will be reading them. Starting with X Woodsy says, anyone seen Berlin Syndrome? One of my favorites of the year. Also Raw and It Comes at Night were pretty good too. Top 20 for me. I haven't seen Berlin Syndrome. I think I've heard of it though. I think it's about like the reason why I heard of it is because it's like an indie movie. And I try to keep up with indie movies, but it's about a guy who like meets this girl in Berlin, and she's like an Australian foreign exchange student or something. And then they develop a relationship, and then she eventually finds out that he's like this crazy creepy guy and like locks her in his house and stuff. But it's supposed to be like a thriller slash creepy movie.
I saw Raw though.
It's crazy because I keep putting that off because I keep going on Netflix and watching movies.
And it just came up on Netflix.
It did, yeah. And Raw is one that I still haven't seen yet. I want to see it really bad. Same thing with It Comes at Night. I haven't seen that either. Yeah, for sure. But definitely going to be checking those out. Let's go to Zach Graves, who says, love the horror topic, guys. I would like to see more discussion on horror. Horror has become almost like a huge category with tons of subgenres under it. While most of the best ones are indie movies, I would love to see if you guys consider doing more topics horror-related content, which has really started to become quality and come to the forefront within the last 15 years or so. We'd love to discuss with you guys. Thanks. People love their horror movies, man.
Yeah, I mean, well, like, a little bit of disclosure here. We were originally going to do, like, just John Carpenter last week, but we both got caught up in some things, and we wanted to do a kind of a special episode. So we just decided to do all horror, and I think it came out pretty fun. You know, it was a fun episode, and we got to cover a lot of our bases. In terms of new horror, I'd be interested in doing an episode. And like I said, James Wan is like kind of the master of today, and I think he deserves a good amount of recognition. And we of course are going to cover some of the older directors too. Wes Craven. Who else? Like we said, John Carpenter, of course.
Yeah, we really, every time we want to do one of those episodes, I want to give it its due. We kind of go back and forth talking about that, but Bane Lee is like, if we're going to do an episode on Carpenter, I want to make sure and see the majority of his films, or at least almost all of his films. Every time we focus on a film director, we want to focus on all their films and really, really make sure and get the conversation considered through their entire spectrum and not just a portion of it or just their popular movies, because that's kind of the whole point of this podcast. So doing stuff like horror movies, or today doing MCU movies, is to reach a bigger spectrum when we haven't found a director that we really have locked down during the week, but we still want to keep it within the theme. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's why we didn't do a John Carpenter.
And there will be, I mean, we're not going to do DCEU films for when Justice League comes out. We have something planned for that as well. So,
Another comment is by Robert Glasgow. He says, The Thing still holds up. It's an exception to the black guy always dies first trope. Have you seen The Thing?
Yeah, The Thing. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, of course. It's another Carpenter classic. The black guy doesn't die for
me. Jacob Bastian says, I like slasher movies because they're at least fun. I don't like how dreary and depressing other horror movies are. Yeah, it's funny how you say that, but you say slasher. But it's true. Slasher movies are a little bit winking at the camera a little bit more. and they're supposed to be played more up on fun and more like ridiculous kind of stuff, which is cool. Yeah. Horror does give you that kind of aspect as far as like dark humor and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think the thing with slasher is that instead of a release of tension or release of emotion, that gives you a release through gore and through violence, which is in its own right and evocative of its own kind of thing. So I do think that the subgenre of slasher has developed into its own kind of category. I think it you know, it deserves its place. You know, of course, there's the Friday the 13th, right?
Yeah.
The
Halloween
is, mm-hmm. is another one.
Halloween's so, probably the biggest. Well, I mean, Friday the 13th is pretty big too.
Yeah, Friday the 13th. I think well, eventually a franchise carried on to mm-hmm. is what we see. But yeah, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Mm.
So again, live horror classics coming from the slasher genre, slasher films.
Yeah, it's crazy because doing Halloween Horror Nights, I know it's been weeks since I did that, but doing it and you see all the slasher stuff kind of come up, it's kind of funny to see how people really enjoy seeing other people get killed.
Right, that's what you're looking for, man. The bloodlust.
But anyways, guys, let's jump over to MCU movies. We're going to be talking about those. It's incredible how they've become very divisive now, but when this thing started out and when it started to really kick in and really make money, and it was really the Avengers, I think, that did that. The one that kicked it off was obviously the 2008 Iron Man with Robert Downey Jr. That one showed how you can make a Marvel movie, and then at the post-credit scene when they hinted at Samuel L. Jackson,
right,
you know, playing that character and advancing it towards the Avengers initiative is what the famous line was. It showed that making a connected universe the way that the MCU was laid out, the way Kevin Feige laid it out, is something that was going to be truly special, because it wasn't just going to be Spider-Man 1, Spider-Man 2, Spider-Man 3. It was going to be all these movies and they're all connected, which is kind of what you know, films are trying to do now, but it's what essentially makes it so popular is the fact that you're not just watching a movie, you're watching an episode of a TV show that you really like, and you get to have like 20 more episodes because they're all somehow connected. And you may like some more than the other, but at the end of the day, it's really cool, I guess is the best way to say it, to see your favorite superheroes come together. And that's the selling point, right? Because that's what comics do. All comics, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the Marvel, you know, comic universe, it's connected too, right? So Spider-Man can pop up in a Captain America comic or vice versa, or Iron Man always pops up in Spider-Man comics, like he constantly does that all the time. So that was always fun in the comics, so they wanted to bring that comic book feel into the movies. I don't know, what do you think about the MCU in general and that kind of like franchise film mentality and having them all connected?
Well, I think, well, even going back to the first Iron Man, I think what they really capitalize on is the idea of making the movie first and then worrying about the whole universe. And I think that's why, you know, Iron Man 2 kind of falls apart as contrasting, because, you know, when you watch Iron Man, you take away that post-credit scene, still is completely own movie. It's a completely own thing. But then the post-credit scene is a promise for after. Like, what can we see if this movie becomes successful?
Sure.
And the movie isn't compromised by those aspects. So I think that's where the first Iron Man succeeds in its own right. And, you know, you're going to cast somebody who, you know, Robert Downey Jr., who wasn't doing great at the time. Jon Favreau, who was, you know, successful, but he wasn't doing like big numbers as a director. But they put this in some, and again, I think this, when you talk about the MCU as a, you know, the meaning of, we could really honestly almost call this like the meaning of Kevin Feige, right? Because it's like, he's the guy who's anchored the whole thing forward. He obviously has produced the first Spider-Man trilogy, the Raimi, or at least Spider-Man 1 and 2. But then because he has a real eye for the comic books, and he understands, like you're talking about, how the Marvel comics are, you know, they're all interlaced, all interconnected.
Sure.
But I think the most important thing that they do in the comics, and I think what they nail in the movies, is that each individual arc has to be its own deal.
Yeah.
You know, every individual story has to make sense in order for the whole story to have life. So,
yeah. And it's crazy because a lot of people point to the MCU as a Marvel formula, but I would put the Marvel formula back with the Raimi Spider-Man movies. That's the, when it comes to a movie formula, that's the formula that is used now as far as having a serious tone or a serious story with a lot of humor, right? That's what the Spider-Man Raimi movies were.
Yeah.
They were like, you know, Spider-Man has to defeat the Green Goblin or he has to defeat Dr. Octopus and it's very serious and his family is at risk and all this stuff. But there's so much humor in those movies.
Yeah.
Like, you can say, oh, what about Blade? But Blade wasn't really known for its like humorous family fun. And then X-Men was before that too. And X-Men as well, it wasn't really known for its like wink, wink at the camera. But when it came to Raimi Spider-Man's, it was wink, wink at the camera. It was funny. But at the same time, it had a serious storyline underneath. And that was used again in Iron Man, Thor, Captain America, these Marvel movies use the exact same thing where it's like a serious story with humor.
Yeah, I think the beginning of Marvel Studios definitely take, I don't think the Marvel that we have now isn't, you know, taking a lot from the original Spider-Man.
As far as like humor goes?
Well, in the sense that like, I think the original Spider-Man trilogy also held his ground and the foot of epicness, you know, and the fact that there was something special about the idea of having a Spider-Man and that, you know, this one character represents, you know, everyone or all of us. And now okay, I think as the MCU has evolved to a point where there's a number of superheroes, either Thor, Captain, or even like the local people, like the Defenders or whatever, you know, it's less special. So there's less of a representative feel or tone to these movies. They're more, you know, you kind of talk about having a serious story with, you know, elements of humor. And I think now there is almost kind of flipped. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's almost like a comedic story where we get some shadier elements in the MCU movies, particularly in like particularly in the three that came out this year, I believe, is more comedy centric than there is an actual dramatic arc, which is fine. I think that's what their identity is now.
I agree with that. I would also agree with that. But we'll jump into that a little later because I definitely want to talk about how that kind of played into mm-hmm. what we have now. But essentially, that formula that the Raimi Spider-Mans use is what kicked off the MCU as far as like humor, comedy with a serious storyline or a storyline that you can take seriously.
Right. And then
and it's not just all jokes.
And I think that's, again, that's the Kevin Feige effect. Because we see him going not producing Spider-Man 3. And, you know, that's when he was trying to get, you know, the Marvel Studios himself off, you know, off the ground, him and Ike Perlmutter. So now we see with Spider-Man 3 not performing as well, not doing as well, because it's less focused on the heart of the characters, you know. And I think that's really where the MCU lies, is how we're able to interpret the characters and the characters' decisions. Now, my question to you is, and speaking on the first Iron Man, kind of being representative of a larger story, I mean, this is the Bush era of, you know, politics. We're fighting a million different wars in a million different places. Mm. And this is all about a war profiteer, essentially, in Tony Stark, mm-hmm. who is selling weapons, selling military equipment. And, you know, I think, of course, the arc of the film is that he learns that that's not right. And being put in the footsteps of the, you know, of the terrorist and understanding that they're getting a hold of these weapons too. Just, you know, it's an allegory for what was happening, what is still happening, unfortunately, and what we see in a lot of our Middle Eastern relations today. So
it really is. It's crazy how close to home that actually is when people read up on how many times that the U.S. has armed the same people that are killing us now are people that we previously armed, right?
Right.
That's
right.
The kind of irony of the whole situation is that weapons are so valuable when it comes to rebellions and when it comes to you know, wars, or when it comes to terrorist organizations and stuff like that. They need those weapons. And when you find out where those weapons come from, it kind of changes your perspective on, you know, countries' involvements in other military or other terrorist organizations. Like, it's crazy how when you find out that a country may not be at war with another country, but when they're supplying the arms to another nation, they're basically kind of like investing into that team to win, right? I'm not gonna say who I want to win, but I'm giving you all the weapons. Well, you're basically saying that, right? No, that's why it's great. The first Iron Man still holds up as one of the best MCU movies because of that, because of a theme that you can grab grab onto and feel, and you're like, wow, that's real, that sucks. And you have the character of Tony Stark, of Robert Downey Jr. still being to do his like Tony Stark isms, I guess you can say, right, or his Robert Downey right. Jr. isms, while at the same time have a serious movie right. where it deals with serious themes, right?
Right. And I think that's also an effect of great casting too. Mm-hmm. With our Robert Downey Jr. and of course Gwyneth Paltrow, who mm-hmm. I don't know if she really had her lines mouthed to or whatever. You know, that's kind of a rumor. But, and Jon Favreau obviously being a part of the film. And Jeff Bridges is Obadiah,
He's great.
And I think that with, whether you could argue whether or not Obadiah is actually a great villain per se, his place in the film is representative of, like, a larger context of the war profiteering that a lot of Americans do. Because let's be frank, a lot of what politicians want is to keep war going. Makes sense economically. There's this expansion of power that keeps happening. We keep electing cowboys in the office left and right. Democratic or Republican, whatever. It's still a broken system. So then I think with Iron Man having Obadiah as like the antagonist is being the guy who's like, oh no, we have to keep selling weapons. We have to, or else, I think there's even a line in the film where he says, "If we're gonna stop selling them, who else are they gonna buy from or whatever?" Essentially saying, like, there's a nonstop cycle of this stuff,
and sure.
At least we can make some money off of it. At least we can make some game off of it. So I think that's what's really powerful about the first Iron Man. And of course, the other Iron Mans don't really go into that, and to an extent, Iron Man 3 kind of makes. Kind of makes fun of it, right?
Sure.
With the fake terrorism and all that stuff. But I think the first one had something really poignant to say, and I think that's what's really interesting about it.
Yeah, absolutely. It works incredibly well, and it still holds up today as well. Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to ask you, though, kind of going back to our first conversation, is about the MCU, right? My brother and I were talking about this the other day, but what's crazy is that if you look at the all-time box office numbers, it's incredible. Incredible. Like right now we may not think it, but 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, we're going to look back at box office numbers and really go, holy crap, the MCU was like king, right? Mm-hmm. Because obviously you have your Avatars and your Titanics and your Jurassic Worlds and your Star Wars, but at the end of the day, there's only so many of those you can have up there, right? Whereas MCU, there's so many movies and there's so many who make box office magic, like they make so much money at the box office, and it holds a staple knowing that all these movies are a part of the same universe and they're all making that much money, right? It's not like just the Avatar or the Titanic or Star Wars The Force Awakens, which is always going to be number one for opening weekend, but having those consistent giant box office numbers be a part of the MCU. I want to talk to you about what is it that makes the MCU reach such a big audience and make so much money, both domestic and worldwide. And what is being used that works so well? What does Kevin Feige do that makes it to be such a powerful box office giant?
Well, I mean, I think it's the whole four quadrant pictures, right? Everybody could go see this. It's the family, the mother, the dad, the kids, they're all going to find something and each of these movies that is going to entertain them, essentially. And I think that's what they do really well. And again, with casting, who they cast, of course, Robert Downey Jr., like I said, wasn't on the height of his career, but he's still a fantastic actor. Chris Evans coming off of Fantastic Four and, like stuff like The Losers and all that stuff. He didn't have like the biggest career, but going into Captain America, they made sure they casted him right. Thor, casting right. Chris Hemsworth, TV actor. All of this stuff. So, and enlisting the talent that they get and focusing on what makes each of these characters tick, what matters, guaranteeing that there's a connective thread through each of these stories in which we're able to relate to these characters on a philosophical and character level, and giving them relationships, with Tony Stark, of course. And we see even the Incredible Hulk, which wasn't received the greatest and didn't have the biggest box office, you still had care and attention to the ideas that they're bringing about. You know, I mean, essentially what the Incredible Hulk, what the Hulk in general, what the character of the Hulk represents is a duality, is the mental illness, is, you know, the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you know, and that's what they highlighted in that film really well. And, you know, so I think that's where a lot of these films fall, is that they're able to take what the audience cares about and put that to the forefront. And then again, we're going to talk about the villain problem a little later, but that's why a lot of villains have to get kind of sidetracked, because we want to focus on the heroes. We want to see their arcs. We want to see their stories. And, you know, that's what Marvel does really impressively. So,
yeah, absolutely. And for me, it's always like, to simplify it, and I know I'm very much simplifying it, but it goes into the worldwide box office is mainly dominated by China. And now everyone knows that now. But China, Japan, Mexico, and then from there it goes into the European stuff as well. But what's crazy is that the MCU is able to perfectly showcase a big budget with giant special effects, incredible action sequences, and that's essentially what is the selling point. That's what gets you in. That's what gets the vast majority of a bigger audience in, whether it be China or elsewhere worldwide. But what they're able to do so well is to do what you said, take a character and actually dive into that character, see what works, see what doesn't work, and then sprinkle in the action sequences and make a combination that works perfectly with both a domestic success and a worldwide success, right?
Yeah.
Because that's essentially what you want to do. A lot of people now, as far as filmmakers and directors now, are only doing worldwide movies. Pirates of the Caribbean, Transformers.
Yeah.
These are movies specifically made only for a worldwide audience, knowing that critically it's not going to do well in the US. So they're kind of ignoring the plot and the story and the stuff that critics look at, and just making a big box office spectacle. But what I like about MCU is that they're able to still do the big box office spectacle and still make special effects and do all the crazy cool action. But really, at the end of the day, if you strip that all away and if you take away the budget, you have a really good story, right? Because that's what the purpose is. And I feel like that is Kevin Feige not only doing the casting process right, but doing the directing, choosing the directors that work well within those movies, choosing the Favreaus, the Kenneth Branaghs, the James Gunns, the all these directors that really want to make a good movie regardless of what the special effects are.
Right.
And that's what works so well within the formula, is the fact that he allows the directors to make the movie they want to make, as long as they sprinkle in what he wants to be sprinkled in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that to me, never underestimate the power of a talented director, right? And that's what, to me, Kevin Feige is good at. He knows that a director with a clear vision can make a great movie.
Yeah, and I think that's where they capitalize. And then, you know, after the Ike Perlmutter leaving, because it really is coming down to the business sense of it. It was originally like Kevin Feige and Ike Perlmutter who were, you know, Perlmutter was his boss, and essentially, you know, Ike Perlmutter was a money guy. You know, he made sure the budget stayed low, and of course he's responsible for some really outlandish comments, you know, in regards to like Terrence Howard and whatnot. But essentially, you know, that's where, you know, the money was more directed, and that's why we saw the budgets get, you know, kind of skimpier and a little more focused. But now, and that's why we saw a lot of sequels coming out. That's why we saw an Iron Man 2, say, before we got like any other, you know, sequel, because they needed, you know, they're trying to collect the gang, collect the capital, collect the money. But then, you know, that's after Perlmutter's departure and having, you know, and having a more wide open space. That's why we see movies coming out now like Black Panther or Captain Marvel or things like that. So there's also now, through the lens of Kevin Feige, there's a lot more diversity that we're seeing in the Marvel pictures. Even Spider-Man Homecoming, more of a colorful representation. And by the way, if you're wondering, for all those who are watching this on video, you're wondering why I'm wearing the Marvel hat, dressed nice, it's because I want an internship at Marvel, guys. Give me a job at Marvel. Kevin Feige, if you're watching this, you guys make plenty of money. You guys are doing it right. Let your boy do it. I go USC Film School. Same thing as Kevin Feige. I know you're rejected five times, Mr. Feige.
All the DC fanboys right now, oh, sucking up to MCU. You suck.
Yeah, I'm sucking up, baby. Give me a job. You ain't got to pay me. I'll be there to work. You know what I mean? Give me, you know, 3.6 GPA USC. Let's go. Anyway, so yeah, no, I think that a lot of their success is rooted in where they find the connection with the people, with the audience, and you know, the audience being able to adapt to the stories that they're telling, you know, because even non-comic book fans are just fans of these stories.
It's crazy, yeah, because to me, when I really noticed that, when I really noticed the non-comic book fans come in was Avengers. Avengers is what showcased a $208 million box office opening weekend, something crazy, made a freaking so much money at the box office.
Highest grossing at the time.
Yeah, and I remember being in college and talking to people who saw the movie, and me being a big comic book fan, and me being like, so like, oh, I love these movies, and I love comic book movies and superheroes, and talking to people who weren't, and people who saw the Avengers, and they're like, have you seen the Avengers? And I'm like, yeah, it's great. I love seeing Iron Man and Thor kick. And they're like, oh my God, I just like the part when it was like funny line, and then they like blow it up. It was so cool. And I'm just like, okay, cool. Now I started to see like other people who don't know what's going on, but they just like the flying suit man shoot the giant alien, right? But that was the thing that it got non-comic book fans on board with this MCU. Avengers was the one that really got the wider audience in to really accept what was happening and to check out the other movies, right? Yeah. It's crazy how it did that. Like, I'm still blown away by that, because I remember seeing Avengers opening night and seeing, like, the excitement for it.
Yeah. Well, even the first Iron Man, I mean, you know, I remember seeing the first Iron Man, and I wasn't even a big, I was like in middle school or whatever. And like, I remember my dad taking me to see it, and he never even heard of Iron Man probably before then. But he was like, yeah, it looks good. I mean, cause what they're selling it on is what makes it different, right? I mean, Iron Man is like a techno sci-fi, you know, almost, you know, thriller, you know, almost to an extent. You know, of course, the Thor movies are more fantasy leaning. The first Captain America is a World War II period piece. And again, they continue to make those, have a streak of making different tones, different feels, and incorporating different genres into each movie. So I think that's a really big selling point as well. And especially in Iron Man coming out in 2008, which is just a year after the first iPhone premiered. Think about that. Mm. A year after the first iPhone. Technology was just on everybody's minds, you know.
Sure.
And it has been on everybody's minds since the 90s, of course, with the whole cyberpunk era movement. But then Iron Man really capitalized on it. And I think that's why, you know, coming out the gate, that was a really smart decision to make, to launch off the franchise with that.
Absolutely. So, I agree with that. But I still feel like Avengers is the one that just really was just like, everyone should see these movies. These aren't just for comic book fans. These are for anyone who likes to see amazing spectacle and a great movie.
Well, the first Avengers movie was like a transcendent experience for me. Like, I remember watching that opening weekend, packed out theater. You know, I can't even imagine how many comic book fans were there or were not there. But it was like, it was a community experience in the fact that everybody there was ready to see, you know, the Hulk and Thor and Nick Fury and all of these characters that we have become attached to. So, and like, when, you know, obviously the pacing of the movie, it starts off a little slower, and it kind of builds and builds to a point where when we see the last big epic fight sequence, which is very similar to Transformers Dark of the Moon ending, by the way. But when we see that last like fight sequence, you're hyped up, you're ready. And then I remember distinctly when the Hulk did that line.
That's my secret, Cap. I'm always angry.
And then he hulks up and then punches the Atari ship. Yeah. Like, I remember the whole theater just like got up and just like started applauding. Like, that was like an iconic moment. Like, I think that's when everybody was like solidified. And then the thing, I mean, Hulk was like the scene stealer in that movie. So with him like batting like low key around, all this stuff, it was just, it really connected with a lot of people.
It really did. It's crazy how it did that. And then launching into more phase two, we got the Iron Man 3s. Ooh. We got the Captain America Winter Soldier. We got Thor the Dark World, and then eventually we got Guardians. Obviously, Winter Soldier stands out in that. Iron Man 3 made a ton of money, and it was extremely...
Yeah, as a follow-up to the Avengers. So yeah. A lot of people... By the way, I gotta say, man, Iron Man 3 was one of the... most disappointing experiences I've ever experienced in my life.
It kind of was. I, like, looking back at it, a lot of people like it. I'm still, I like Rebecca Hall. Shout out to Rebecca Hall. But other than that, I'm just like, The thing that stands out to me the most, obviously, Winter Soldier, seeing that opening weekend was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
A lot of people regard that as like top five ever superhero movie. I don't put it up there.
Oh, really? You don't? Why not?
I don't. I've said this before, and I'll say it eventually in another video. But I feel like this is my thing about Winter Soldier. I was watching Winter Soldier throughout the entire first hour of the movie, and I was in. I was so in. I was like, man, this thing's like a thriller. It's grounded. It feels like this could happen in real life. Captain America is so invested. There was cool martial arts scenes. The action scenes were like top notch. I cannot lie, RB3, when that twist happened, I'm cool with the Hydra twist where everyone's Hydra or whatever. The Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is actually Hydra.
Yeah.
I was cool with the twist. The thing that took me out of the twist, that really took me out, was the German scientist. He's like, I've tricked you, Captain America.
Oh, yeah,
I've been living in a computer for the past 60 years. And I was like, no, this is like a cartoon now. Like, it immediately became a cartoon to me. Whereas, like, if they didn't have that, if they just said, agents of Hydra infiltrated S.H.I.E.L.D., it became S.H.I.E.L.D., it became, you know, one and the same. Cool. Mm. But that living in a computer for six, I was like, that doesn't make any sense. Well, how? Like, you don't even explain it. You just say, I've been here. I've outsmarted the computers. And then you're like, no, dude. I don't know. It just took me out of the movie. It took me out so much. If it was like a secret organization that was infiltrated early on, we could have found that out a different way. Not by a guy who lived in a computer. I don't know. Yeah. That just, it really took me out of the movie. I remember seeing that and being like, that doesn't make sense, though.
Well, you know what? For me, and
it really dropped it down for me because I was like, everything else was cool, but that was just so whack.
You know what? For me, I'll say this. Like, in regards to that, you're right. That moment does stand out. But to me, that movie already has so many what the fuck moments that I was just like, I was just cool with it, whatever they were giving me at that point. Like, at the beginning, they kill, like, Nick Fury, and then they have that whole thing, the Hell Hydra thing, obviously, and then
I thought it was cool, man. They had Bucky kicking
the
ass.
The whole Bucky. So in that movie, they have so many moments where I'm like, what the? It felt natural.
That to me took me out. To me, that this movie could have stand, if you didn't tell me this was like a comic book movie, and it was just about a guy who's just, you know, super talented at fighting or whatever, and you just grew up in a different era. That's Captain America. And then he's coming into this world where all these people are like infiltrating secret organizations and businesses and all that. I was like, that sounds cool. Add a guy who lives in a computer, you get a ridiculous comic book movie. Like, it works, but it doesn't work as well as what you were selling me on. Because you were selling me on a spy espionage thriller. And what I got was just another MCU movie.
Yeah. Well, for me,
good MCU movie, but it's just another one.
For me, that's the Iron Man 3 effect, right? Like, the whole Mandarin twist. Well, first off, I got to say this. I remember watching Iron Man 3 when I was in high school, and I was part of, like, this engineering club. So we were all excited for Iron Man 3, right? We were so excited. I think we ended up buying up, like, half the tickets in, like, a local theater, like, a real small theater or whatever, and just all crowding up and seeing that. And I remember the first 45 minutes was going by, and then they had the whole sequence where, like, the house was exploding and all that stuff. I turned to one of my good friends, and I was like, yo, I think this is the best Marvel movie ever made, man. I think this is it. Because to me, that was, like, the perfect first act, you know?
Yeah.
And then he starts hanging out with this little kid. I'm like, oh, this is a little weird. And then the whole...
Guy Pierce?
Yeah.
Oh, man, he was terrible. Is that his name, Guy Pierce?
The main villain, Guy Pierce. I forget his name. Adrian Killian or whatever. So him, and then but Tony's hanging out with like this Ty Sheridan, you know, Rebecca Hall is just popping every now and then. I'm like, it's a little weird, but okay, I'm with it. And then like the whole Mandarin twist. I remember watching. I cannot forget. I think there's a moment like we all have in different comic book movies where we just watch that moment and we're just like, what just happened?
Yeah.
And then like you can't escape that for the rest of the for the rest of the film.
That's me.
That was that moment for me.
I agree with that.
And I literally I shit you not, for the rest of the whole hour of the movie, I was like, oh, but he's really the villain. Like, he just played him, you know? Like, yeah. That's why I really, I was like, he's going to come back, right? Nope. Like, this has to, yeah. Nope. Like, I've almost never, it's been like 4 years since that movie came out. I'm okay with it now. I get what they're going for now. Sure. I just don't think it was funny. But yeah, that was a weird moment for me.
Yeah.
Actually coming off of Iron Man 3 was Dark Thor: The Dark World 2, which is another movie I didn't like. So the Winter Soldier was something that bumped it up for me.
But the one that really, to me, talking about it earlier, the one that changed a little bit the Marvel formula was Guardians of the Galaxy. Yeah. Guardians of the Galaxy is still considered one of my favorites because I feel like in Guardians they finally did it right. Whereas, like, in Winter Soldier or in Thor: The Dark World or in Iron Man 3 or in all these other previous films, whether it be a First Avenger or any of those, they were trying to figure out the perfect formula. In Guardians, to me, they figured it out. Comedy. They were just like, screw it. We're just going to, like you said before, let's make a damn comedy movie. Yeah. It's set in the sci-fi space world or set in a superhero movie. It's first a comedy, then everything else, and that's what Guardians did first. And that's when I was watching the movie, it didn't click on me until like the first like 30 minutes, and then I was like, oh, I get it. It's a comedy. I'm supposed to be laughing this much, because at first I was like, why am I laughing so much? Why is it so many jokes? And I'm just like, oh, it's a comedy. That's genius. You know, setting all these big stakes and all these huge situations and huge scenarios and world-ending events inside a comedy, inside like a fun whatever adventure where these guys are cracking jokes the entire time. That, to me, it just set in, and I was like, that's it. That's what you need to do. Be a comedy. Be funny. Do your own thing. Don't worry about being, you know, the other superhero movies that we've had before, or don't worry about being this crazy super serious moment. Just be ridiculous and be fun and be over the top. And I enjoyed that so much, and it clicked in me. Like, it immediately became, like, the most fun I've ever had in any MCU movie was the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh yeah, and I remember they were screening, like, I believe like before the movie came out, like a month before the movie came out, they showed everybody like 7 minutes of footage for it, 7 or 17 minutes. I can't remember exactly what, but they showed us that whole escape from prison sequence.
Sure.
When like Groot had like threw away the battery or whatever, and then like the alarm started going off. So I remember seeing that early, and I was like, yo, this movie has the real potential to be something extraordinary, you know. And, you know, it's like their own side Avengers, but in space, but the Star Wars, you know, kind of influx of it. And I think it was really well done, man. I mean, to me, that's one of my personal favorite MCU movies, of course, as well. And you're right, they did go for the more comedic approach. But they also, I think this is probably one of the first and few Marvel movies that had a real emotional arc when it comes to the character, the main character of Star-Lord, right? Having his, you know, seeing his mother die from the very start. You know, of course, a lot of these films are about, you know, troubled parentage or whatever. But where Guardians was really the first one to make that a moment to really emphasize that. And I think it's one of the strongest opening pre-credit sequences to me was seeing that whole moment. And then going into that, now you have context for the rest of the film. So when he does have that moment where he is reaching out to his mother in that fight with Ronan the Accuser, it is a real touching moment. So,
absolutely.
To me it was one of the first Marvel movies that incorporated a lot of that, the more comedic, wacky elements, but also the first one to ingrain the emotion into the story and into what we're seeing in the motion picture. Because a lot of times we're just told what our emotions are supposed to mean in these movies. I think Iron Man 2 is a good example of something where we see and we hear a lot about the dead father, but we don't actually see how that
affected Tony.
How that affected Tony.
Yeah, we see that more in Civil War, I think.
And that's exactly where I was going to. It's like Civil War hits that to the next level.
Let's jump into that. Let's jump into Civil War. Because Civil War is
phase three,
and it's what we're in now. And it really jumped into, was it phase three? Yeah, it was.
It's the first film in phase three. It was originally supposed to be Ant-Man started phase three, but then they moved it to...
Civil War was the one that it came in with a lot of hype because it came with the Civil War title, right? And that's based on the famous comic book that I've read and that a lot of people have read before. I'm sure you've even read it too, right? The Civil War comic. And it was very different. It was a very different take on it. But essentially, it was the Tony Stark versus the Captain America storyline. Mm-hmm. And it was taking that and really making it into like a world, a real world situation as far as security, right?
Right.
Because it's all about security and consequences and private corporations versus government corporations or mm-hmm. government entities.
Yeah, right? that's exactly because what it's about.
The Avengers was a private corporation. And in Captain America, was we got to keep it that way. We got to keep it private and keep it our own. And not have to worry about jurisdiction and all that jazz that gets so muddled up in government conspiracies or government, you know, meddling. And Tony Stark was like, well, the government is here for a reason, right? We can't just ignore the government and ignore these countries who are voting for something differently, right?
Right.
If people have a voice and we're just ignoring that voice, aren't we just as bad as everyone else? There's two sides that are actually really good arguments, and they argue this well. In this movie... worked really freaking well with that. I think so personally, and I think it dealt with those two sides in a very realistic standpoint, even though it's obviously a giant superhero movie.
Right. I mean, of course, you know, a lot of people make the analogy of, you know, Captain America representing a more conservative belief, the Iron Man conserving a more, you know, like liberal belief in terms of government structuring, government interaction and, you know, in some cases interference, I guess.
Sure.
Whereas, you know, of course, Captain America represents like individualism, you know, making this of your own and answering to your own. But without the things that we established in the Winter Soldier, it could have came off as really negative and really, you know, like why were we siding with Captain America? But we've seen that the government is not the most secure place in this universe. We've seen they could be overtaken by Hydra and all that jazz. And again, with the Winter Soldier, you know, having that whole idea of the government surveillance, that was coming out at a time, of course, with like the Edward Snowden links. I think right before that, WikiLeaks and all that stuff. You know, Snowden and of course the other homeboy, I can't remember his name. Two separate issues, but they're all leaking information with the NSA.
You know?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, mm-hmm. with the WikiLeaks and again, they're all it was all playing into the idea of we're being watched, we're being spied on. Our technology is controlling us, and the government's controlling us. So we have to break free from that. And I think that's where Captain America: Civil War comes into play. Was like, well, what happens if we have to? You know, what kind of questions do we have to answer? Is it responsible for us to just go into different countries and start, you know, and inadvertently killing a bunch of people?
Sure. In the purpose of a bigger good, right?
Right, right, right. Where do we draw the line? Where's the morality?
You know what's great about that is that it's you can see both sides.
Yeah.
That's what's great about this movie is the fact that you can't just say Tony's wrong, Captain America's right, or Captain America's right and Tony's wrong, because there is an argument for both sides. And I like that they painted it in a very realistic way with that sense,
right?
Like making it two sides. And also with the ending too, with Bucky, because mm-hmm. you can make the argument that Bucky should be given another chance. But if it were me, I can make the argument and say Bucky gave away his chance.
Yeah.
And if he's being used as a weapon, and if he's only a weapon, isn't he kind of just riding his own death sentence in a way?
Right.
That's what to me was so great. And that's why I kind of became Team Tony Stark during the movie. Whereas like going into the movie, I was Team Captain America, right? Because I prefer Captain America and I don't really care for Tony. But during the movie, I was like, holy crap, Tony's right. Like we can't just let this killer going around. And he's like, well, they brainwashed me. That's why it's okay. Well, either way, it's still not okay. Like if you were brainwashed and you started killing people, like, and if you say it was out of my control, I'm still going to put you down, because I'm saying, well, what if they do it again? Right?
Right, right.
It's that argument where it's like, no, I'm not going to let you kill people even though you're being brainwashed. And if you're a danger to yourself and to society, sorry, but you got to die.
Right.
And I love that at the ending where Tony Stark's like, oh, and you kill my parents? You got to die, bro. Yeah. I'm going to kill your friend. Sorry, man.
And you know what? And you just, you know, you kind of just struck a nerve with me in discussing that, because it's like, now, you know, I'm kind of looking at it in terms of the Winter Soldier. Yeah, maybe he is a weapon. Maybe Bucky is a weapon. And maybe we should put the weapons, you know, weapons down. And that's how Tony looks at it, at least.
Yeah.
Whereas Cap is really trying to hold on to, you know, his friend, obviously.
Yeah.
But his friend is, you know, being used, being manipulated. My question to you is, because of Tony's experience with dealing with weapons or agencies, you know, of course, we've seen the first Iron Man. Of course, he's going to be a little more, hasty or a little more hesitant to be involved with somebody who's this dangerous killer, this assassin. So do you think that theme is what carries into some of the decision making made in Civil War?
Or Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the character of Tony Stark and Captain America are very well defined with their previous movies, right? With Tony's trouble trusting weapons, and with Captain America's trouble trusting
the government.
Trusting the government.
And I think that's what is inflective of a lot of things we see today. And politically, I should say.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Drawing a line in the sand of, you know, here's a side of America that doesn't necessarily want government involved in everything.
Sure.
And that want and that doesn't trust what politicians are doing. Here's another side of America who wants to see the government step in and regulate some of the more dangerous elements of American living. So, and then it provides an argument for both. But I think here it's a more logical argument because you're able to see Cap's side and the Winter Soldier. So
it's great, dude. It works so well. Obviously, what we have now is a ton of new movies. But before we jump into the new ones, I kind of want to talk about a little bit of negativity towards Marvel, because there is a negativity.
Right.
One of the main negative aspects of it is that a lot of people now, it's a very current topic, is that they're not serious enough, that it's a little too comedic. I've heard this argument now. Right. It's coming up now, especially with Thor Ragnarok.
Right, right.
But a lot of people now are saying that Marvel movies are just so comedic that you just feel like if you've seen one of them, you've seen all of them, right? It's mm-hmm. that whole, like, have you seen this one? Have you seen that one? And it's like, well, I've seen them all if I've seen one of them, because it's the same formula and it's the same style brand of comedy. What do you think about that?
Well, I think they do a good job of implementing different brands of comedy into each of their film. And I don't think they're necessarily following one set formula. I don't get this whole thing of, oh, they're all going by one formula. Sure. You know, is The Winter Soldier honestly the same film as Guardians of the Galaxy 2? Honestly, no. They're not. They're different movies. Is Civil War the same movie as, you know, Doctor Strange? Yeah. I mean, they're all different. They're all, you know, and of course, you know, maybe the origin stories have similar elements, but that's life. I mean, a lot of people have to go through traumatic experiences to discover what is within themselves. So, of course, we're going to see, you know, Iron Man, Captain America, Ant-Man, and Doctor Strange all kind of follow a similar thread.
But to counter that, do you feel like stakes? Do you feel like you can feel the stakes when there's so many people cracking jokes?
Well, now that's where I might differ a little bit, because in particular with Thor Ragnarok is a movie that I saw and I enjoyed. I enjoyed a lot. I think it's a really good movie. But part of my problem is that there's so much at stake, and yet they're just cracking jokes every couple minutes, to where at the end of the day, I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen Thor Ragnarok.
I mean, we can, okay. To be honest. I mean, what is it? We're Tuesday. If you were going to see it, you saw it.
Yeah, okay. So Thor Ragnarok spoilers. And I'm going to put a little spoiler thing here.
Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert!
The whole idea of they literally have just destroyed Asgard.
Sure.
Odin has died.
Yeah.
Thor loses an eye. All this is just like transpiring, and meanwhile, like, the Hulk is talking like a 5-year-old. So at the end of the movie, like, I remember even having a conversation with somebody earlier, like, yeah, I mean, nothing really happened at the end of the movie. It's like, well, yeah, a lot happened at the end of the movie. You know, Asgard got destroyed, all this stuff. I'm like, well, yeah, I guess, but nothing's ever like,
feel it.
Yeah, I didn't feel it. Yeah.
Okay.
So
you know what I call that opinion? Wrong.
No, no.
Because I saw Thor Ragnarok, and I think it's one of the best MCU movies ever made. I loved it. And I definitely want to go into a little bit more of it. But to me, Thor Ragnarok, to me, is what I equate to Guardians of the Galaxy. The first one. Where they're so aware of what the situation is, and they're so aware of the comedy that you know what they're going for, as far as like making a comedic movie, making a comedy, and then just adding these bigger overarching themes to it, plus the character of Thor, plus the character of Hulk. To me, it just worked perfectly. And I know a lot of people feel the way you feel, because the way you feel is how I felt about Age of Ultron. Age of Ultron, to me, was like, I felt nothing. like
right.
Sokovia, all this stuff. And I was like, I don't feel any of that. I just feel like this is a joke to Tony, even though he's like, it's not a joke. But anyways, remember your mom when she's your mom said that, and he's like cracking right. jokes. And I'm like, right. dude.
Language.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Stuff like that where it's like you're literally trying to stop something horrible from happening and you're talking about stupid stuff. And like to me, it just Age of Ultron didn't work. And Age of Ultron is an example of that. But to me, Thor Ragnarok was so self-aware, so self-aware that it worked like perfectly for me.
Well, you know what? I will say this too. And I think, you know, going back to your point of how, you know, these movies, you know, have his own like individual tone
sure.
or whatnot. I think whereas I didn't like it as much in Avengers 2 and Age of Ultron, I liked it a lot more in Thor because it was shot like a comedy. It feels mm-hmm. like a comedy. It looks like a comedy. And then whereas...
You're talking about Ragnarok, right?
Ragnarok, yeah. Whereas something like Age of Ultron, they were going out of their way to make it look like a dark movie.
That's what they tried to sell me on the fact that there's like, this is going to be the darkest Marvel movie ever. And it's like, it was the lightest Marvel movie ever.
James Spader's cracking one-liners, which is fine. I love James Spader. Yeah. I'm happy to see him in anything. But in this movie, it was just like, they have like these dark templates, dark color templates. They made it widescreen, which is really weird because the first Avengers is... You know, full screen, they do that for more dramatic purposes.
Do you feel like overall that argument doesn't hold up? That it's too funny, blah blah blah.
Well, no, I think as we see more and more different films, we could see more variety in tones, and I think we're gonna see that.
You think the humor is different enough where it works on its own?
Well, yeah, I think the humor in Ant-Man is a lot different than something we'll see in like
Ant-Man
and Ant-Man's Guardians funny. Too. Yeah, yeah.
Ant-Man's, but you know, Ant-Man is still an Edgar Wright script.
Right, right.
A lot of people forget that because they're like, Edgar Wright didn't do this movie. He kind of did because he wrote the script and his name is the first name that comes up after the director in the credits.
Yeah.
So he did write the script. It says story by Edgar Wright. Yeah. So.
I think they kept a lot of the elements. I know for sure they changed some things.
Of course he did, yeah.
Yeah. I think the Tony thing was originally like Edgar Wright, though, like the whole aunt friend Tony, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, I think it comes down to the tone and the way they... And I think that also contributes to the look of these Marvel films, sure. right? These are movies that have a very distinctive look, very distinctive quality cinematically. And I know there's that whole video essay out there, I think like Patrick Williams that did it or something about, you know, why do our Marvel movies look so ugly? I disagree with a lot of what he says in that video. In terms of, I get that they have a little more grayscale and
I just think of Game of Thrones.
There's a little more gray in the image than the air is black.
Sure.
So they come off a little lighter. But I think that's more towards the effect of having a consistency in projectors. It's a lot of technical talk that I'm just saying right now. But
overall, they're different enough that they work.
Yeah. Overall, they're all different. They all have different looks, but they still kind of have a consistency in the way they look sure. in their shot. And I think especially, you know, the movies that do look a lot more different are films that are set in different realms, right? Like we see like the Guardians and the Thors have a different look than something, say like the Winter Soldiers and the Ant-Mans, you know, have a different look aesthetically. Sure. Same thing with Doctor Strange. You know, Doctor Strange is a beautifully looking like black light, neon kind of looking film when it's like in space or when it's cosmic. But when it's on Earth, it kind of looks like every other Marvel movie, which I think is...
That's why to me Thor Ragnarok worked so well, because I mean you feel like you're just in that weird world that you're in, so you mm-hmm. buy into the, you know, New Zealand Australian type humor, you buy into the tone, you buy into the jokes, you buy into the characters, you buy into you know, Thor being the way he is, Loki being the way he is, Hulk being the way he is. I just love this movie so much. And I know that your argument is kind of true, but at the same time, I didn't feel that way. Where it's like, it's all about feelings, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's like, I feel like it works so well. And even though we still had those big moments happening as far as like Asgard being destroyed and, you know, losing an eye and all that, I felt like the serious stuff with Anthony Hopkins, with Odin losing his dad and seeing visions of his dad and all that stuff. And like even coming up to him and being like, dude, I can't do it. What do I do, dad? that worked well for me. And that was like a very emotional moment. Even the scene when he's fighting Hulk in the arena and Hulk is punching him and he sees visions of Odin. I thought that worked perfectly because I can only imagine being on the brink of death and you see your dead father, like me personally imagining that, right? Mm-hmm. Where I can imagine just seeing your family, instead of your life flash before your eyes, your family flashes before your eyes. And it flash, and that using that as motivation to just unleash his full God power. That to me just, it works so well for me. And I just loved it so much. But that's just a personal take, obviously. I want to talk about a little bit more on the negative side, the villain problem that the MCU faces, because this is something that always comes up with conversation as far as Marvel Cinematic Universe, is that we haven't really had a good villain, to be honest. I mean, they're promising we're going to get one with Thanos, but we haven't really had a good one yet as far as in the movies go, right?
Yeah. Well, I think Loki is a good...
Is he a villain?
Well,
every time, I'm telling you, man, every time someone brings up Loki, I had a huge argument with my buddy at work because my buddy and I were going back and forth and he's like, oh, the best villain is Loki. And I was like, he's not a villain. He's just not. Like, even in the Avengers, I get he was a villain, but even then he was still a little too irreverent for me. You know, a villain would be like Obadiah in the first Iron Man. That was a villain, right? Because you saw it and you were like, all right, that guy should die. He should just die. Whereas, like, ask the average moviegoer watching the movie Avengers, did he want Loki to die? No, I mean, not really. Like, ask most people. Most people would tell you didn't want him to die. Yeah. Whereas, like, Obadiah in the first Iron Man or Hela in Thor Ragnarok, like, yeah, she could die. She should die. But for Loki, you don't never really want him to die. That's why, to me, I'm like, he's not really a villain because you don't wish for his death. Like... You wish for the death of other characters in other villains that come up in other movies. With him, you're just like, he's just having a temper tantrum. He's funny. He could stay. You see what I'm saying? Right. Like, I just don't feel him as a villain. And everyone is like, he's the best villain.
I think that's why I like Loki a little more.
Okay.
Because it adds like another layer of complexity to it. Like,
okay.
Do I really feel like seeing this guy die? No, because he has a wit, he has a charm to him, but he has a relation to one of our heroes. He's the adopted brother of Thor. So, you know, we want to see, we're almost kind of rooting for Loki just as much as we
for redemption, right?
Yeah. So, and I think eventually he does have some redemption in the later Thor movies. And,
and pretty much every Thor movie, Thor Dark World and Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah. And now, I mean, to me, he's basically a good guy
at this
point. Yes,
absolutely.
And, but to that point, though, I do think that he is good. And I mean, he's good and bad. And I think that's what, and to me, that's also what makes, this is more controversial, but I think the Winter Soldier and Captain America, the Winter Soldier, is a great villain because it's Bucky Barnes. You know, and because he has to fight his way to redemption, because he's trapped in this system that is electrocuting him, is torturing him, that he wants to escape from, but also is just a terrifying menace to our heroes, to Cap and to Black Widow and to Falcon. So I think to me, that's why, you know, he's a great presence. He's a great villain.
Sure.
In that film. And same thing goes for, you know, homeboy and Ego.
I was just joking. I said
Malekith. No, definitely not. That's an example of how to.
Oh, Ego the Living Planet.
Ego the Living Planet. Yes, in Guardians 2. The reason to me why he worked as a villain is because for the whole movie he wasn't a villain. In the last 20 minutes, you find out that he's a villain. But you've grown just as much of a bond to him as Star-Lord has, that is just as heartbreaking when he makes that turn.
Sure.
And when, you know, Star-Lord has to make the decision
to
fight this guy.
I really do feel like there's a villain problem with the MCU, personally. I do think that's a fair argument. There absolutely is a villain problem. There isn't really a villain that I can connect to the most. Everyone who I ask always says Loki, and I always counter with that he's not a villain. But to me, it's like what Kevin Feige said before, and you brought it up earlier, is that he doesn't really care about the villain, to be fair.
Yeah.
Like, he's always making it about the hero because he feels like that is more powerful to make it about the hero. I can counter and I can say some of the best comic book movies ever have had a fantastic villain, whether it be the Joker, whether it be Logan. I mean, I think Logan's villain is underrated. I still think Boyd Holbrook, mm-hmm. Donald Pierce. Holy crap, that's a great villain. And yeah. I felt like I both like him and hate him at the same time.
Right.
I both am like, man, he's great, and I'm both man, he should die at the same time. Yeah. That to me is a great villain because I'm like, I want to see him die, but at the same time, damn, he's good. So if he lives, I'm kind of okay with it, right? Right. That's the kind of villain that we see in other movies, like even Magneto in the X-Men movies, right? Mm-hmm. In the first few X-Men movies, we see superhero movies, comic book movies do some pretty damn good villains. I think Watchmen does that great too, yeah, with Ozymandias, being the villain. I can counter Kevin Feige and I can counter MCU and say you do have a villain problem. I think the best Marvel villain we've seen on screen is the Purple Man from Jessica Jones. I think he's the best. I think Kilgrave is the best villain we've had. See, that to me is perfect. I see him and I'm like, man, he's great, but man, he has to die. Like, that's what I was feeling watching Jessica Jones season one, is I was watching it and I was thinking, man, this guy is amazing. He's such a great villain. I can see where he's coming from. But at the same time, you took it too far, bro. You got to die. You know what I'm saying? Whereas, like, if you say that about Loki, I'm like, I don't want him to die. He's cool.
Yeah. Or if we're counting the Netflix stuff, I think they have a little more of an advantage.
I agree, because they have a season. Time. They have more time. I agree with that, which is why I feel like that's a fair argument. But again, I can counter, and I can say the Joker. I can say Boyd Holbrook, Donald Pierce, and Logan. I can say Magneto. So I can counter you by saying there is good villains in movies. In superhero movies, where we don't really see that in the MCU movies.
Right, right, right. And I think there's also a degree to arguing whether or not the scale of these movies necessarily implicate a great villain. You know what I mean? When you look at something like The Dark Knight, it's a very intimate story. It's a very intimate Batman story. So having a more intimate villain works a little easier, whereas something like Thor... let's keep, talk about Thor Ragnarok, that example, where it's literally about the world ending. They have to have a villain that is not going to actively be there every scene. She's just going to be like calling shots or whatever.
You could say that about a lot of the movies too. You could say that about Ultron. You could say that about
Ultron too. Yeah, Ultron. I think that's a problem, what they did in Ultron and what they did in the original Avengers. Where they have like, oh, if we take out the one, we could take out all of them. Even though Avengers 2 didn't really do that. Avengers 2, they had to kill every robot. But even still, like, the whole hive mind mentality is kind of
okay. You hate that,
yeah,
because that's pretty common.
Yeah, I mean,
Star Trek Beyond did that too.
Yeah, but they still had Idris Elba character in there, Stranger Things.
Stranger Things did that too.
It's a pretty annoying trait.
I call it the Phantom Menace effect.
The Phantom Menace effect, right.
Where it's like the Phantom Menace. We destroy the one ship, we destroy them all.
Yeah.
It's
like,
shit, all right, let's do it.
Yeah, it's easy to do. And Transformers, Dark and the Moon, obviously.
And now, shout out to Game of Thrones, because they did that too.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm, okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. A lot of people, as soon as I saw it happen in Game of Thrones, it happened this season. Where they're like, wait a minute, if we destroy him, we destroy them all. And I was like, no, the Phantom Menace is back.
Right.
Even though I like the prequels and stuff, but yeah, that's a very annoying trope.
Yeah.
I got you.
No, yeah. I know one of the criticisms that has been overarching in a lot of Marvel movies has been the music, right?
As far as the music doesn't hit as well.
Yeah.
I disagree with that as well.
Yeah, listen, to me, I know that the whole thing kind of started from that Every Frame of Paintings video. Mm-hmm. By the way, Every Frame of Paintings is probably one of my favorite YouTube channels.
I love it.
Of all
time. Yeah.
He should make more videos. But the video is kind of whack, if you ask me. Because to me, what I think the video does a good job at illustrating
similarities between each one, right?
Right. And they have a larger discussion of temp scores, which I think is a good discussion to have.
That's a great discussion, because a lot of people don't know about temp scores.
Yeah. And as somebody who makes music myself, I agree with a lot of points he makes on that. However, I can't really get aligned with a lot of the notions he was preaching about the MCU not necessarily using the right type of music for what scenes, only because a lot of what he's doing is making comparative analogies. He has an example in that video of, using one piece of the Thor theme to another, scene in the film. And to me, that's kind of like a straw man's argument. You're just, taking what makes you feel like could work better here. And I think, even if the scores aren't necessarily memorable, the point of a score is not to be memorable, it's to serve the story.
Sure.
and, you know, having a score that underlines the theme, the emotion, the what's at stake in each of these moments, you know, is a score that is successful.
That's a good point.
To me, the Winter Soldier is one of the best soundtracks in the past 10 years.
For MCU?
Well, I'll say the Avengers. And again, that's another problem I have. Avengers I think the Avengers score is pretty iconic. It's, I think that's a very iconic. Yeah. Like the dun, 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 dun. Like that is brilliant. That, and I think if we have more time with that score, you know, I think sometime down the line, you know, we could see that being compared to like a Star Wars theme or a Superman theme, where
as far as how iconic it becomes,
timeless it is. And I also think the Winter Soldier has some pretty iconic music in there too, because it's so heavy, like drawing on like the spy thriller heist, you know, the digital score. I think that works really well too. So
you know which score is great?
Which one's that?
Thor Ragnarok. Go see it, guys. Yeah. Thor Ragnarok score is awesome.
Yeah,
I loved it. I think it worked really well. It has that typical like 80s synth kind of vibe that had in there
when
Thor was kind of running away.
Yeah,
flawless, guys. Yeah. It worked really, really freaking well. Well, let's move.
Oh,
go ahead.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, isn't it kind of weird that Blade Runner, Thor, and Stranger Things all coming out around the same time,
and all three like, of them are badass as hell.
Yeah,
well, badass.
Not Blade Runner, but they all have that 80s synth.
Blade Runner is you got to calm down, bro. Yeah, Blade Runner is awesome.
I'm not a fan, but
all right. That's another podcast. let's move on to some of our favorite films. If I were to put you on the spot right now, RB3, I'm gonna put you on the spot, put a gun to your head, and I'm gonna say, name your top three MCU films right now. Ready, set, go.
The Avengers.
One,
yeah. Okay. The Winter Soldier, and probably right now I'd put it. It would be close between Civil War and the first Guardians. It would be close between those.
Are those in order?
Yeah, definitely Avengers 1. Definitely Captain America, Winter Soldier 2. And
the third one, you're not sure. Maybe it was
Civil War or Guardians. And but yeah,
I've always had Guardians as my favorite.
Oh, really?
I'm still gonna have Guardians as my favorite. I've never walked out of a movie being that happy and that excited in a long time. And that's when I told you that I felt like the comedy worked.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna go two and three right now are so close, are razor thin close. But if I had to pick, I would say two, Civil War, just because I feel like the story elements we talked about, the realistic elements we talked about, the rooting for both sides that we talked about, just makes it a great freaking movie.
Mm-hmm.
Three, Thor Ragnarok.
Really? Wow.
Thor freaking Ragnarok. I felt the same way in Thor Ragnarok that I did in the first Guardians, where I was just like, oh, it was so much freaking fun.
Right.
I had a blast. I just enjoyed every moment of it. It was my favorite Avenger. I mean, I'm assuming that, remember I told you back when we did the reactions at Comic-Con, when we reacted to Thor Ragnarok, that he's my favorite Avenger.
Right.
I love Thor so much. I love the character. I've loved him for years. So seeing him kick that much ass and seeing him be that irreverent and that having that much fun worked perfect for me. I love Thor Ragnarok so much, and I can't wait to debate people and talk about it more, because I'm pulling out all the guns, man. I'm ready. I'm ready to shoot back. Anyone who wants to shoot at me, be like, oh, Thor sucks. I'm like, come at me, bro. Come at me, or don't come at me. I don't know.
Right.
Whichever one.
Now, I want to pose to you real quick.
Yeah.
I made some pretty controversial comments, I think, on the on Spider-Man Homecoming in the past.
Oh, yes. We didn't talk about Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yeah, yeah. Which is a movie that is in the MCU, but it's technically Sony.
Sure.
Long story short, a lot of people, not a lot of people, me, I said that Spider-Man Homecoming is saying something either really troubling or really effective, either way you choose to look at it, with this his use of interracial marriage and with the Vulture. It was also his use of having like a working class man being.
Well, which one though? Because it's two different things. I think there's
a relationship here.
Okay.
I think the whole idea of the relationship of the small business owner who gets screwed over by the big corporation, turning into the villain, and the idea that that the film essentially hides his villainy through the use of interracial you know, interracial relations. So
okay, I see what you're saying.
What's your take on that? Because
explain the interracial thing more.
Well, to me, it's like
a working man screwed. That to me is like that. That's a great origin story for a villain, in my opinion.
Right.
I think that works. That makes the Vulture a better villain.
But is that villainizing the middle lower class and making our protagonist, you know, being the Tony Stark, the rich billionaire, philanthropist who, you know.
I don't know. That's a great point. To me, the character of Tony Stark, we talked about this before. We talked about this at the Red to Comic Con.
Right.
Remember that when we were talking about it? I kind of like that Tony Stark isn't a clear-cut hero, at least in my opinion, right? Because it's all the way they've painted him since Age of Ultron. Because in the first one, he's a hero.
Mm-hmm.
But since Age of Ultron, he's always had a little bit of a...
like an insanity streak to
exactly
him,
right? And he plays God a little too much, right?
Yeah,
where he's like this big corporation who frowns on other organizations and frowns on other corporations, but he doesn't really point the finger back at himself as much as he should,
right?
So I kind of like that he is kind of another villain in Homecoming. He's part of the villainy in Homecoming. He's part of Vulture's villainy because he's the one who created the Vulture in the first place. To me, that makes him both a villain and it's the Batman effect. Batman is both a criminal and a villain, and he's a hero, right? I mean, a lot of people forget about that because they get used to seeing Batman is a hero, but in a way, he kind of is a villain as well. I don't know how much you've read about Batman, but he is both a villain and a hero, whereas like he creates things, he creates situations, and he motivates people. He motivates the insanity because he's insane himself. He's crazy. Batman's completely insane. And he kind of invites more insanity that go a little bit too far on the other side, right? Whereas, like, he's nonviolent and other insane people want to be violent.
Right.
I kind of like that Tony Stark kind of creates that corporate mindset of, like, I'm over you, creates it, and then tries to fix it. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Ultron, right? Where it's like he creates it and he's like, shit, I got to fix this now.
I think you hit it right on the head right there. I think you hit it in terms of the motive. You know, what having Tony Stark's actions being the influencer for why the middle or the lower class people are so troubled or so disturbed or why they have to turn to this root of villainy, I think is a way of looking at it to where it's like, yeah, of course, you know, this is kind of what happens in America too.
Sure.
Right? The rich 1% elitist. And their tax breaks and their tax cuts kind of affect the little guy a lot harder than they expect. So now there has to be a fight against that. Now, of course, in terms of having Liz, you know, discovering that her father is the Vulture.
Sure.
Because that kind of the reason why that twist works is frankly because we expect her dad to be black.
Yeah.
You know, we don't pick up on her being mixed race.
Sure.
So do you think using that as a factor in this movie is prevalent, or what's your take on that? Like,
I don't know. I thought that was such a good twist.
Yeah.
Because I know you had some thoughts on it because you thought it was a little too much, right?
Where it's well, like, it's just like, I don't.
What they're trying to say as far as like an interracial relationship is almost villainized? Is that what you were saying?
Kind of, it's kind of like, you know, I don't know. It's just kind of weird that the one placement of our, you know, we have another black lead in there with Zendaya, but our kind sure. of our main entrance point to, you know, a black perspective.
Oh, yeah.
In the movie through Peter is through Liz.
Sure.
And of course, your dad's going to be the villain. You know?
Sure, sure.
It doesn't really sit right what that might implicate. But you know, you could read it either way. You could read it as something that, you know, it's more relatable, it's more human, it's more forward thinking. But in a sense, is it also saying that interracial relationships are, you know, something that could lead, or if you know, somebody who's with, you know, a black woman, you know, what are they trying to say? I'm not exactly sure, and that's why I have a little trouble with that whole
got
notion.
It.
So, you know,
I don't know. I think you bring up good points. I don't want to say that you don't bring any points, because I do feel like that's a fair point. However, I do feel like we've come to a point now, so much, obviously there's so much more discord, but I think it makes sense to have an interracial couple. I think we're at a point now to that twist, as much as you can go, huh? It still makes a lot of sense where you're like, oh, yeah, I could totally see that happening in real life where we don't assume certain things. But once it comes up to full light, it makes sense where we're like, yeah, I could see Michael Keaton being her dad and being stuck in the situation and Peter just didn't see it coming.
Right.
I think that it adds for a very organic, a very realistic twist that works incredibly well in that movie, almost too well, where it's the best part of the movie. It's literally the best part of the movie is that twist.
No, it was a funny moment, and I'm not criticizing Spider-Man. I love that movie. I love it. It's probably one of my top 10 Marvel
superhero movies.
Yeah. So it works a lot for me. It's a little troubling because where else do we see interracial relationships in the MCU? We don't.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, so it's just like here it is, and it's presented.
We can go on and on about that too, the fact that all these superheroes are like the whitest superheroes you've ever seen in your life.
Well, see, now there's a more implement of diversity, and I think,
sure,
again, that's the Mike Perlmutter leaving effect, because, you know, Mike Perlmutter is infamously racist.
Sure.
He has said multiple derogatory things about African-Americans, about women, about a lot of different groups. So with him, with Kevin Feige kind of anchoring the ship now, we're seeing a new Black Panther movie,
sure,
which, you know, something that Perlmutter wouldn't have greenlit. We're seeing Captain Marvel, and hopefully soon we see a Hispanic hero take the forefront. Hopefully soon,
man. Yeah. Come on, where it at though?
Well, see, now that's the thing with Spider-Man Homecoming implementing a lot more diversity,
sure,
and having a much more cast that represents a lot more accurately what New York is.
Mm.
Now, do you think the whole idea of the side character and Ned being like the traditional Asian sidekick? I know that was a controversy as well surrounding that.
That's a fair point.
Yeah.
I personally don't. To me, there comes a point where realism is realism, and that's realistic as far as having a diverse group of people be in that kind of school, because they really made it a point to show you this is a gifted school, whatever, like a smart people school. So you had, you know, a different array of people. You had Indians, you had Asians, you had different races of people who were exploring, you know, succeeding more in life. And the fact is that there is a lot of Asian kids in schools like that, and there is a lot of diversity.
I went to a super,
I don't think that's bad to say. I don't know. I feel like we're in a, I don't think it's bad to say that. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think it's cool. I think it's great. Cause like I went to, you know, Arizona State, and there's a ton of Asian kids there, and I thought it was great. And they've always, you know, been in that special programs and been in different programs that kind of highlight their,
intelligence,
not just that, but their initiative, their drive to succeed. Right.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think it worked well. I think it worked really
you
well.
You know what? You nailed it around the head. Cause I did go to a super smart, like a math and science school. So it was in where my school, you literally had to apply, you had to interview,
sure,
you had to like show a project and all that kind of shit. So it was like applying to college, and like I did go to a high school just like the exact same as the one
Peter Parker
goes to in that. So I relate to a lot of that, and I do think, yeah, there's some, but of course, coming off of the whitewashing controversy that was Doctor Strange, it comes off a little funny still. So
that's a good point. We can get into that a lot too later.
Yeah.
Let's jump into some questions that some fans love before we run out of time. Lenny at Lenny97 says, who is more impactful for today's superhero movie landscape? RDJ, Robert Downey Jr., or Hugh Jackman?
Well, I say Hugh Jackman was definitely somebody who started the crave of getting a little known actor and building him to the forefront of being the superhero character. And of course, Wolverine came before Iron Man. But I think RDJ has a pretty big impact on what we see as superhero castings today too.
Is the more iconic of the two as far as superhero movies?
Well, to me, Logan is the better movie out of all of their films. And kind of now, you know, Robert, to me, it's weird because the more I see Robert Downey Jr., the less I'm liking his performances in these movies.
Okay.
Whereas with Hugh Jackman, it's almost like every time I see him, he's getting better and better.
That's such a good role. Point.
And even to the point of like Logan, where I'm almost like, he's almost like Oscar level. Yeah. Well,
we've talked about Hugh Jackman before, right? Because we've talked about The Fountain. We've talked about other movies that he's been in. And Hugh Jackman, I've told you, he's such an underrated actor. Like, this guy is phenomenal. Like, I'm talking Oscar good actor.
Right.
is Oscar level good, Oscar winning good.
Right.
I think he did actually, right? Did he win one for Les Miserables? Or he was nominated.
Yeah, he did win.
I think he won for Les Miserables.
No, he didn't win. He didn't win.
But he was nominated. Should have been because he's great. However, on a personal level, if I would answer that question, I would say 100% Hugh Jackman on a personal level.
Mm-hmm.
On a business level, on a historic level, it's Robert Downey Jr. for me. Mm-hmm. Based on how much money those movies make, based on him being the face and the heart of every one of those movies, whether it be on a negative light or in a positive light, even in Thor Ragnarok, you can still have those Tony, like mentions of Tony Stark and mentions of jokes that he said in Avengers. Remember Point Break?
Yeah.
Point Break, all that stuff that he has little moments in there that still make him the most iconic face right now in superhero movie landscape. On a personal level, Hugh Jackman all the way. Like, he's number one and he's has a more emotional effect on me, right? Like Logan breaking my heart, you know, seeing a Logan version of Tony Stark wouldn't really break my heart as much as like Logan did.
Right. And I think that goes into, you know, Hugh Jackman is an actor playing a character. Robert Downey Jr. is playing himself. So. Yes,
that's a very good point.
Yeah,
that shows that Hugh Jackman has range too.
Right.
Hunter Gassaway at Gassaway Hunter says, "I actually love Captain America: The First Avenger. I think it's fun in all the right spots and has a great romance angle with Hayley Atwell." Shout out to Hayley Atwell. Beautiful. I love Hayley Atwell. Beautiful. She's great, and she's great in Black Mirror too. For you guys who have seen that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But I do not like Captain America the First. It's notoriously one of my least favorite MCU movies. Sorry, Hunter.
I kind
of
have to give a face on this one. It's not one that I will say.
It's one of my least favorites. I always find it so boring and so just, I don't know. And my family loves it. Like, my dad likes it a lot because of the World War II angle. And my brother kind of likes it too. But I just find it. I think the character of Captain America never found itself until Winter Soldier.
Winter Soldier, yeah. I agree. But I do think it does hold some place in influence and impact because it is almost a direct influence to Wonder Woman.
That's a very good point. Without the whole period, it's very similar to Wonder Woman.
Yeah, without the whole period piece.
But that's also kind of low key why I don't think Wonder Woman's that great.
Yeah, it's not the greatest.
Shots fired. Boom, boom. Pew, pew, pew.
The music in The First Avenger is incredible.
Oh, it's great.
Yeah, like the Aaron Copland inspired score is really nice.
Adam Johnson says, how do we think the MCU's three-phase corresponds to the classic three-act structure? Do you think it works well? So basically he's saying, do you think it's kind of similar to the three-act structure?
No.
It doesn't work well.
No, it's not. Because I think now is... Well, it depends on how you look at the... I think each installment in the trilogy... for each of these different characters represents an arc in a three-arc structure, right? I mean, it's Iron Man 1, Iron Man 2, Iron Man 3, I think, is a full structure. I think Thor, Captain America, Thor 2, and Thor 3, and same thing with the Captain America series. However, I can't agree with the notion of having each phases because in each phase we do get a new character, a new set of team, and new...
That's a good point.
So, like...
But maybe in the Avengers, right? I think if you single out Avengers... Possibly.
Kind of, but then Avengers is like having your climax in the beginning of the movie where they win. So I can't have it. See, that's for me where the whole TV show analogy kind of falls apart.
Sure.
Is because, like, are we dealing with a season finale every two seasons or every two episodes? I don't know. So to me, that's where it gets a little complicated.
Sure.
So I don't think I think as an overarching story, I think they all have their own life and their own stuff, but I think more within the trilogies of each of these characters is more of a where I see the structure. But what about you? What do you think? Like,
I think it could work. I mean, I think you can call Avengers with the post credit scene set up to Thanos, team getting together, Act Two, Age of Ultron being like the stepping point or the middle point where they have some sort of conflict between each other, and then Act Three being the finale, being the either dealing with the conflicts they have within each other and then choosing to fight a bigger threat being Thanos.
Yeah, but it'll be a long act three though, because we already have...
That's a good point.
We already have like just as many phase three movies as we have in the other phase, and it's only been like 1 or 2 years. So.
Yeah. Curious George says, Incredible Hulk is so overrated, way too short. Overrated. Rushes everything. Ed Norton is so inferior to Mark Ruffalo. Roth is wasted. Third act is dumb.
Wow.
Shout out to you, RB3. He's calling you out.
Yeah.
Incredible Hulk sucks.
I like the Incredible Hulk. I think it's a good movie. I mean, it's not the best. Of course, you can see, like, you know, there's all these stories of they're cutting out Edward Norton, like, 30 minutes in the film, like, 30 minutes that he wrote or whatever. And, I mean, I get it. You know, it's not the greatest, but I think it's fun. I'd be interested to see where Edward Norton actually added a lot more of his individual character into it.
I still think Mark Ruffalo is so good, man. I think he plays a great Hulk. I think Edward Norton did a good job. I'm not saying he didn't. I just think Mark Ruffalo, it's crazy how well he works in Avengers. Like, right off the bat, you buy him as being Bruce Banner, and you buy him being the Hulk and all that.
Right.
It's crazy how, like, I remember, you know, pre-Avengers and leading up to Avengers when they were casting him, and they casted Mark Ruffalo, and they said, this is your new Hulk, blah, 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 he's going to be in the Avengers. So many people were so, I don't know if you remember this, but they were so hesitant. They're like, what? New Hulk? Whoa, yeah. What's going on? Edward Who is Norton. This guy? Yeah. Mark Ruffalo? Whoa. Edward Norton's our Hulk. You know, this guy, he's not going to work well within the group. This is not going to work. And how quickly people forgot about that when they were in the movie watching the Hulk. And they were like, best part of the movie was a Hulk. Best part of the movie was a Hulk. And Bruce Banner was great. Mark Ruffalo was great. Like, they really bought into him quick. Like, real quick. So that's a testament to him.
Yeah. I still like Edward Norton, though.
Nikki Baldwin says, I feel like Doctor Strange is horrendously underrated. I don't feel like it's as derivative of Iron Man 1 as people claim, and it's hilarious. What do you think of Doctor Strange?
Doctor Strange is a movie that I actually watched again, and it's
really
good. I haven't
seen it since the first time.
Oh, really? Yeah, I just watched it, and it was one of your top 10 movies.
It was. When it came out last year? Yeah, last year. I put it up there, man, because for me... it's the character. I love Doctor Strange, man. I can't get enough of the Sorcerer Supreme and the comics and the weirdness of it. I really hope they dive into more of that in the next future films and all that.
Right.
As far as his weirdness and the fact that I've always pitched Doctor Strange as like he's a guy saving the world who no one knows that saved the world.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's like he's doing it on a different plane of existence.
Right.
So
right,
everyone's
right.
Like, yeah, Iron Man, go Tony Stark, go Captain America. And it's like Doctor Strange saved the world like 20 times in the same time that it took Iron Man to save it once.
Right.
Like that's the kind of cool vibe that he is. And he's a guy who, how do I say this? Sacrifice and confidence in himself without needing the acceptance or approval of others.
Right.
That's
right.
The character of Stephen Strange in a nutshell. Yeah. And I really enjoy the movie. I think I still like Thor Ragnarok more. What's the most overrated MCU film in your opinion? Parker Campbell asks.
Well, what's one that's like...
Overrated.
I mean, they're all pretty highly regarded, right? I mean, I'm trying to think...
Overrated. Of one that
I maybe the first Avenger, because
but it's not
that's not highly regarded though.
Yeah.
And the same thing with Age of Ultron. It's like I want to say that's overrated, but not a lot of people
like it. That's a good point. I guess the only film you can say is the Avengers, but that wasn't it was
to
good.
Me. I like it. Yeah, I can't really think of maybe Iron Man 3. I say Iron Man 3. Iron Man 3. So
that's a good point. A lot of people do like Iron Man 3. So. I'm trying to look for my answer, but to be honest, I don't know if I have one. I guess if I had to say one, I would say The Avengers. I like The Avengers, but a lot of people put that as their number one all-time superhero movie.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't. So I guess by that point, I would say it's overrated. But even then, it's the first part of them coming together. That's kind of what makes it great. It's not necessarily the fact that it's an overall better film than other films we've had.
Right.
So let's see what other people are saying. Gregory says, my favorites are Winter Soldier, Guardians of the Galaxy 1, and Iron Man. A lot of people like those three movies quite a bit. So that, to me, is always going to be up there.
Yeah, I mean, Iron Man is, like, according to James Gunn, that's his favorite, right? And so that's, like, the direct influence of Guardians. If we're talking about underrated, what do you think is the most underrated?
Ooh, MCU? That's a great question. Thor Ragnarok? No. Thor.
That's like a 96 on Rotten Tomatoes, right?
Yeah, I know. That's a good point. But I do feel like time is going to kill this movie. I guarantee it. Guarantee it. 2 weeks from now, we're going to be hearing about like
the backlash.
Oh, yeah. Thor Ragnarok. Why do people love this movie? I'm already hearing it on my Twitter. I'm already hearing it on my Facebook. Like, people are already kind of tweeting at me and putting Facebook posts of like, oh, I don't get why people like it so much. And I'm like, bro, triggered, bro. Triggered. underrated.
And the first Thor movie is really good.
First Thor movie is come so underrated. It's such a good movie. And everyone is like, oh, it's all right. But it's such a really good movie. I think that one would be my underrated if I had to guess one.
Iron Man 2 is pretty good to me. To me.
Tony Wagner says, I think Guardians 2 is in the top three MCU films. Ooh. It's much better than the first for having better cinematography, development, story, and being unique.
You hit it right on the nail, man. To me, Guardians 2, I don't know if it's better than the first one, but it does have a stronger emotional core to me. It has a better sense of what they're going for tonically. And while maybe not every single joke hits, the jokes are really effective and really funny. But I think the emotions are there. I think, like you said, the cinematography, the production value is there. And, you know, it's funny, you know, with Thor Ragnarok and with Guardians 2 being two MCU movies that came out at the same time, both have kind of an 80s musical influence to them. I think it's funny. Like, I think to me, it's like
I think it worked better in Thor.
Yeah. But see, that's what I'm getting to. Like, I think Guardians 2 is more of the, like the Midwest, like the Middle America kind of 80s, whereas like the Thor Ragnarok's more like the city kids, the punks, you know.
That's cool. I like that. See, here's my thing about comparing Guardians 2 and Thor. Guardians 2 had comedic moments that didn't work for me, whereas every comedic moment in Thor worked for me. The moments that didn't work for me in Guardians 2 was some of the, and I know people love him, and I like him a lot too, but the Yondu stuff.
Yondu.
I didn't find Yondu to be as funny as people were saying. And the Yondu and Groot, baby Groot scene, the ones that's like 5 minutes long and it's just them killing people. I thought it was okay. Like the with the arrow, killing everyone on the ship and like murdering everybody. I was like, or the scene where baby Groot's bringing back all the stuff. Like,
yeah, that to me was what
it got old like in 2 seconds.
For me. It did. Yeah.
Anything with Yondu and Rocket just didn't work for me.
Did you like the Mary Poppins stuff?
That was funny, but that's one line. Whereas like Yondu and Rocket, they're like little side mission. None of it worked for me.
I love that. None of it worked. I love that. The taser phase.
All that stuff didn't work.
When they're in the ship and then like they're going at hyperspeed and their face is like dissolving.
That didn't work for me. Oh, no. I was watching that and I was like, this is so silly. It's so cartoonish.
I loved it.
I just didn't buy into it. The stuff that did work for me, Drax.
Drax. Oh, that's so what did funny. Work for you.
Drax and Mantis was so freaking funny. I loved it so much. Yeah. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
But everything else to me didn't work as well to make it as good as... I loved Guardians too, but that stuff to me brought it down a little bit. Danielle says her favorites are Winter Soldier, Iron Man, and The Avengers.
Yeah.
She also really loves Spider-Man Homecoming. Right. I'll probably leave that as the last comment just because we're running out of time.
Right.
Shout out to Avengers, shout out to Winter Soldier. I told you I love Winter Soldier, don't get me wrong, like a lot of people are probably gonna say I don't like it, but I do. I just felt like that computer scene just took me out. I was like, it was so good, it was gonna be one of my favorites, if not my favorite time.
I understand that, and actually I would even go as far as to say, not in particular with the computer scene, but the whole thing of them bringing Nick Fury back and all that stuff.
Yeah, that like, was a little
to me if that wouldn't have been there, to me, it probably would have been my favorite Marvel movie.
Sure.
Just for all the what the fuck moments and like how that all played out.
One thing too, before we leave, Civil War. Something that I didn't like about Civil War, because I have to say it, because I talked about everything else, even though it's in my top two, top two. I didn't like the CGI. I think the CGI didn't work. I thought there were moments in the scene where you were like, that's really cool that they have a Black Panther in a Spider-Man suit. And there were moments in the scene where they were so painted on the Spider-Man and Black Panther suit that it just didn't work for me.
Yeah, I mean, there. I mean, a lot of it was just like straight up CGI Spider-Man or straight up CGI Black Panther.
It didn't work. To me, it was like you could see there's a guy in a suit, and that's take advantage of the guy in the suit. Don't put CGI paint it on him because it felt like they painted onto him.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, the Black Panther trailers are still working out the CGI. I hope that's fixed. Yeah.
I hope that's fixed.
Yeah. I think Black Panther has the potential to be something really special in the MCU.
I agree. But so far, right now, it's everyone's talking about Thor Ragnarok and how cool it is.
I will say, though, I think the villain in Civil War is underrated.
I agree. Yeah. I don't think he's great, but I think he's good. He works better than most villains. Mm-hmm. I would put him maybe top five, top three villains for MCU movies.
Right.
All right, guys, that's our thoughts. Make sure you leave us your thoughts because we will be reading your comments. Thank you once again for listening. Name us your favorite MCU movie. Name us your favorite MCU moment or your favorite MCU line, something more specific so we can get like a laugh out of it and we can read it for next week. What is some things you don't like about MCU movies? What are some things you do like about MCU movies? And also how DC and Marvel can stay friends forever because that's what it's all about. Ace and RB3, we're peacing out. Shout out to superhero movies, DC and Marvel. We can be one. We can work together. We love you guys.